This is a Village Soundcast Network original production.
Hello, and welcome to Lend Me Your Ears. This is a film, show, and podcast where we see something new in cinemas or on a streaming service and connect and compare it to older films, other films by the same filmmaker in the same genre. We span the world of cinema to talk about movies here every couple of weeks. And my name is Karsten Knox. I'm a film writer and critic. I'm the host of The Knox Office on the CBC Information Morning, and my blog is called Flaw in the Iris, and it can be found at halifaxbloggers.ca.
And my name is Stephen Cook, and I'm a freelancer and film enthusiast here in Halifax.
And on today's episode, we are checking out some films on Netflix. We're doing a deep dive into the streaming giant. We're going to swim in the stream and see what we come up here with here on Lend Me Your Ears.
And welcome back to Lend Me Your Ears for the first installment of this week's show. And we are looking at films exclusively that we watched on the Netflix streaming platform. And Karsten, what do you watch your streaming platforms through? What is your choice of device at home?
We've got the Apple TV box there. So we've got, and we subscribe to a whole pile of these streaming services, probably more than we need, to be honest. But I do enjoy finding feature films on there and series from time to time. And Netflix is just one of the many these days.
Yeah, we've got a Roku is what we've been using, and it's pretty good as devices go. It's a stick, so it's wireless only, which can be problematic when the Wi-Fi is a bit spotty, but I think for the most part it's been pretty good. And certainly Netflix is one of the premier platforms, probably the first thing we subscribe to, because as it turns out, Netflix was also included as an app on my Blu-ray player when I got my Oppo Blu-ray player several years ago. And so that was the first one I actually subscribed to because it was so easy to do it just through the Blu-ray player. And then since then, we've gotten Prime, and we had Apple TV for a while because I got an iPhone through my former workplace, and that gave me a free year of Apple, Apple Plus, I guess, which has since expired, but we're going to renew because we're going to be dropping Netflix shortly. So the timing of this show is actually kind of fortuitous because we got to see a bunch of things I wanted to see before we give it a rest with this platform for a while.
And why did you choose to give, of all the platforms that you subscribe to, why did you choose to give Netflix the boot?
I felt like out of all of them, it was one that we were watching less and less. The last thing we watched was a Korean legal drama called Extraordinary Attorney Woo, which turned out to be a long kind of commitment because it was, I think it was like 18 episodes, and each episode is between, over an hour, at least like 70 minutes to 90 minutes long. So we kind of wanted to get to the end of that before we said goodbye to Netflix. But this had a bunch of movies that were on my want list to check off, and that was helpful as well. But I think just the fact that they have virtually no classic movies. I think they've got like a handful of titles, haven't really improved that lineup at all in the last year or so. The series that they'd been coming up with hadn't been as intriguing. Like I may miss out on the last season of Stranger Things. Who knows? I mean, I suspect we'll go back to Netflix at some point, but for the time being, there's a bunch of things on Apple I want to catch up with, so we're going to swap them out.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And it's funny how seismic Netflix has been in terms of the way we enjoy entertainment. It is, I think, still the world's most popular streaming service. But it has definitely changed the movie industry, because not only does it produce and develop its own feature films, but it buys and distributes other pre-existing efforts. So there's kind of an interesting mix of sort of mid-level, mid-budget pictures here, a lot of genre stuff, and then, occasionally indie things. I think most of the films we're going to talk about today on the show are the ones that are produced by Netflix themselves, but there's at least one that we're going to talk about that they've sort of brought in our distributing. And looking back at the last 5, 6, 7 years of Netflix, and I sort of went through my blog, Flaw in the Iris, to see how many had made like my top 10 lists. I tend to do two top 10 lists, my favorite movies and sort of a an under-the-radar list as well. And there were a number of them. There are a few excellent Netflix films. I'm thinking of Roma, obviously. Yep. The recent Glass Onion, which was terrific. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is, I think, to date, the most recent Coen Brothers film. It's on there. Enola Holmes and its sequel, certainly the first film I really loved. Always Be My Maybe, Operation Mincemeat, which we've talked about on our show. Don't Look Up, I Don't Feel at Home in the World, This World Anymore, The Little Hours, The Meyerowitz Stories, New and Selected, and Oaksha. These are movies I very much enjoyed, and I was really glad to see them. A number of them I wish I could have seen on the big screen by virtue of They're how beautiful they are. But
like The Irishman would have been, I think I would have appreciated that a lot more had I seen it in the theater rather than it being restricted to Netflix. As we know, we almost got a theatrical screening here and then it got canceled at the last minute.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Very frustrating.
But that's another thing. Like, what's the future for Netflix? Are they going to try and produce those kinds of Oscar bait pictures like The Irishman? Which apparently was very expensive, and I don't know if it made its money back for them because they're a little more cagey about the success.
Yeah,
we'll
have no way of knowing. You know?
But or will they go for more middlebrow entertainment like the movie we're about to talk about, We Have a Ghost? I'm not sure. I mean, the one thing I've noticed is they've definitely dialed back the number of sort of equivalent to big screen blockbusters. Like, I mean, I really like Triple Frontier and Extraction. These are two action movies that are available on Netflix. A little less so The Gray Man. But, you know, there is something about the small screen only release of some of these really large budget action movies that makes them feel a little more disposable, I guess, or less memorable. I'm not sure what it is. They haven't been able to figure out the marketing the same way that theatrical release has, because it's an event when it shows up in cinemas.
Yeah. And I mean, we did get the new Luther in the theater for a week, and we got Glass Onion for a limited run.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, at least they're recognizing that there is a certain swath of the audience that wants to see it on a big screen, and then they can actually make some money that way. You know, I saw Glass Onion the week it came out, and I will watch it again, hopefully before the end of next month. I think end of April is when we're going to finally pull the plug on Netflix. But it also generates publicity for those titles, because they have a tendency that once something goes up on Netflix, it doesn't really get promoted terribly well. And they're not very good at, tooting their own horn, as it were, about some of the cool stuff that they have to offer. And that's always kind of annoying when something's so buried that you have to go hunting for it. And it's almost like a snipe hunt, because you don't know what you're looking for half the time. And you hope something will leap out at you. And, occasionally they'll put up like, you know, here's some more, you know, if you like this, you might like these kind of things. And I feel like maybe they've been responding to that very complaint in more recent months. But I found for the longest time, it was, you know, the volume of what was there and the ability to find out about it was pretty slim.
Yeah, and then the algorithm, because we all know about the algorithm and how it supposedly shows you things that it thinks you will like, and whether that's right or not is something I don't really understand. But the problem with that is that it's so impersonal, like the feeling that the computer is trying to figure out what you will like versus, you know, something that's really curated for you. I mean, it's the opposite of the Criterion Channel, which is what we love about that service, right? We both have that. And it's full of classic films. And of course, that's right in our wheelhouse. But there's also the feeling that there are groups of people, you know, who know about films, who are choosing them, and, you know, they're showing them to us in a way that feels personal, it feels human. And I think maybe the biggest problem with streaming services in general is the feeling that, oh, this is a replacement for Blockbuster on the film front anyway, and you're wandering through and there's just so much
flipping
stuff
through the digital aisles.
Yeah, and you're just like, there have been times, and I'm sure everyone can this experience that they've been on Netflix, where you're just flipping through and you're not able to decide on anything because you're sort of stymied by this huge wealth of choice without really a sense of what's really going to work for you. So anyway, I guess what we're doing here today is trying to push against that with some reviews of films that we've watched that are on the streaming service.
Yeah, well, Criterion has definitely climbed to the top of the list for things I want to hold on to because of the fact that it is curated, that they all, every, you know, the start of every month, one of the first things I do is go to Criterion to see what their new collections are, because quite often it's a number of things that won't necessarily appear in their, you know, physical media Criterion collection, as it were, but things that they've licensed and for a limited time that they're able to show that maybe TCM can't be bothered to show. I mean, this month they've got a selection of Paramount pre-codes. The pre-code era between the dawn of sound and 1934 is one of my favorite periods in Hollywood history. And, you know, I feel like I've kind of exhausted the Warner Brothers and MGM titles that have been appearing on TCM, but Paramount is kind of an outlier, and there's a number of titles there that I've been wanting to see for years and years. So that's a real treat to have that amongst, you know, and then there might be a selection of African or Iranian cinema that will, you'll have half things I've seen and half things that kind of line in the dovetail with those other titles that make a lot of sense. And it certainly makes a lot of more sense in terms of the way that I watch movies.
We've joked that here on this channel, on this podcast and show, we could devote it to the Criterion channel.
Oh, easily. Yes. You know,
that wouldn't be difficult.
But we
do want to offer a wealth of possibilities for our listeners. And let's talk about We Have a Ghost. It's directed by Christopher Landon, written by Landon, based on a short story called Ernest by Jeff Manna. And it is it's on Netflix, as will be everything we're going to talk about today. And it's reasonably new. I think it came out in the last month or so. Now, I came of age as a movie lover in the 1980s, an era that had a lot of crappy movies, a lot of good movies, as any time in the history of Hollywood. But that was a time when the horror comedy really took hold. But for every Beetlejuice or Lost Boys or Ghostbusters, there was a Mr. Vampire or Killer Clowns from Outer Space or Saturday the 14th. Now, you can feel the affection in We Have a Ghost for that era, but I don't think it's nearly as good as the best. So we got the slightly troubled Presley clan. They buy an enormous old pile. I mean, a huge house. Even for old American houses that feature in movies, this seems enormous. The parents are Frank and Melanie, played by Anthony Mackie and Erica Ash, and the teen brothers, Fulton, played by Niles Fitch, and Kevin, played by Jai Diallo Winston. Kevin is the bookish younger brother who plays guitar and has a fondness for Creedence, which struck me as a little weird for a Gen Z African-American kid, especially it's an entirely unexplained. It's just one of his character details, and I'm just like, okay, that's odd, but okay, cool. But you know, there are a few plot holes here, and it's very much the order of the day. So Kevin meets Ernest, played by David Harbour, with a terrible comb over. He's the ghost haunting their attic in this new house or old house that they have purchased. Turns out Ernest is a nice ghost. He's entirely silent, but for the traditional ghoulish moaning and groaning, but he is stuck. He doesn't have any memories of who he was in life, and Kevin decides to try to help him. And he shoots a video of Ernest on his phone. But when Fulton, his brother, and Frank, his father, get wind of this, they post it online, and before long, Ernest is a viral sensation. So the movie is kind of about how Father Frank, he wants to turn Ernest into a moneymaker for the family, because now they've bought this house, they have no money. But that conflicts with Kevin's effort to figure out Ernest's origins with the help of his classmate, his neighbor, and romantic prospect Joy, played by Isabella Russo. I thought the young actors were really good here. I thought Harbour brought his usual warmth to a role, even though he's got nothing to say. And there's support here from Jennifer Coolidge and from Tig Notaro. They are enormously welcome, though we don't get nearly enough of them. I was really mixed on this, mixed to pretty much not happy with this movie. Stephen, what did you make of it?
I thought it was pretty lightweight. It felt like this could have been like a Bob Hope movie in 1940s or something like that. It certainly feels like that kind of concept. I enjoyed it in fits and starts. I feel like it constantly kind of loses momentum from time to time. It's 126 minutes. It's over 2 hours with about 90 minutes of plot. So it felt like, you know, well, if this had been a little snappier and a little more light on its feet, I feel like it probably would have achieved what it was after, you know, in terms of tone and everything. But having said that, I feel like I enjoyed it, wishing that you know, that less was more in the case of this film. I really like David Harbour as an actor. I mean, even when he was playing Hellboy in that Misbegotten reboot, I liked him as the character, even if the film wasn't working for me. And he's great here as Ernest, you know, the schlubby dude in his bowling shirt, you know, stuck in his attic for all eternity. And when they finally get to cut loose, I enjoyed that part of the film immensely. But it takes a long time to get there, and there is a lot of wheel spinning, you know, especially with the, you know, when they double down on the kind of the father-son relationship and the fact that the dad is kind of always going for these schemes, these kind of quick success schemes that never pan out, which of course puts a stress on the family and a stress on the marriage. So maybe a bit less of that, you know, that you can tell that story in fairly decent shorthand. And yeah, I mean, it's Christopher Landon. He gave us Happy Death Day 1 and 2, and Freaky, and those are pretty, you know, momentum driven horror comedies that worked really well. I'm not sure why the energy here is any less than those. It really shouldn't be, but it's one of those things. It's like, it's a Netflix film that I enjoyed watching, but I feel like I'm glad I didn't, you know, pay $10 a seat in the theater.
Yeah, and I mean, how often do we say that about films on Netflix, which is a little bit sad. Might explain part of the reason why you're not hanging on to the service.
I don't regret watching it. I mean, there was enough stuff in it that I liked. And again, like, you know, Jennifer Coolidge and Tig Notaro certainly juice up the scenes that they're in. And you know, the whole stuff involving the government conspiracy to trap Ernest, you know, is interesting. But I feel like a lot of it could have been compressed into a more efficient and compelling bit of the horror comedy.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think the problem here is the script isn't nearly tight enough, funny enough, or scary enough to succeed. I mean, it sort of overlaps genres, right? Which I like, but you've got to succeed in at least one of those genres, and I didn't feel like it worked in any of them. And I also felt, like you, that the pacing is totally baggy. This is a long movie, and it feels every minute of it. There's a mid-movie car chase sequence that might be the worst edited of its kind I can remember seeing. Like, it looks like it was shot well, but it's just cut together in a way that makes no sense, constantly switching perspectives. You know, it's one of the things that should be a course in Hollywood for directors is spatial, you know, coherence. So you know where you are at any point in the terms of a scene, and it's especially important in action movies. I feel like, you know, the Chad Stahelskis of the world, you know, on the John Wick movies have that in spades. You always know where you are in those movies. And this is just, it's just a terrible, terrible car chase. But, you know, in the end of the day, we don't fall in love with these characters. We don't. The film doesn't invest in the key relationships, not really between father and son, which I don't really buy their connection when it's, of course, it's resolved through the course of the film, mm-hmm. or between the teenager and the ghost. Like, what is their connection? How are they working? And I didn't buy it, despite the talent on screen. So it makes it really hard to care about much of it.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to the fact that, you know, Netflix hasn't been producing movies for very long, and I don't think they're are necessarily people there with that kind of experience to know the elements of film storytelling, you know, of looking at a script and seeing what'll work on the screen and what won't. I mean, obviously a lot of that falls on the director as well, but there need to be other kind of creative voices at play. And I always wonder what the budgetary limitations are on Netflix films. Well, obviously they're not putting the same kind of money into these as is going into a theatrical feature, or what's expected of a theatrical feature these days, but certain things, you know, editing doesn't really cost money as, you know, not as much as special effects and big name actors, and the same with having another pair of eyes go over a script. So it kind of wish that more attention would be paid in that direction.
Right, so back here on Lends Me Your Ears, we're talking about films available to be seen on Netflix, and we have seen a number of them today. Next one on our list is Windfall. This is directed by Charlie McDowell, written by McDowell, Jason Segel, and Justin Leder. And McDowell is the director of a film I really liked from some years ago called The One I Love. It's sort of an independent indie sci-fi picture. This one is similar in some respects in that it's set in a luxurious sort of vacation home with a small cast, but tonally it is actually quite different. What we get here is a pared-down existential thriller featuring a few characters with no names, all the hallmarks of a pandemic picture, mm-hmm. you know, shot clearly, you know, to try to get some work done at a time when you could put the least amount of people sort of in danger and still make a feature film. This is a clean 92 minutes, and I thought it hit its targets with admirable concision. It's a diverting time waster at worst. Jason Segel is a burglar who has broken into the desert retreat of a tech billionaire. He's looking for money. He's found some, along with a gun. He's feeling like, all right, this is a good day. I've definitely done well. Just as he's about to depart, a man and his wife arrive for the weekend. They are, of course, the owners of the house. They're played by Jesse Plemons and Lily Collins. Now, having purloined a bit more cash from the wealthy couple, Siegel's character is about to depart again when he sees a camera hidden in a tree. This changes the stakes for him. He's going to want a lot more money now because he realizes, uh-oh, I've been identified, and there is, you know, I'm going to need a lot more money in order to get away. So then the negotiations begin. And I thought the casting of Windfall is really interesting here. Siegel brings a lot of likability to the role. I think generally he's a pretty likable, kind of schlubby kind of actor. He's not, you know, it's amazing to me that he's a leading man. I think he works best in comedic roles, but like the Apple TV series Shrinking, which I think he's quite good in. But, you know, in this kind of piece, it was is an odd presence because, you know, we sense his frustrations in life without knowing much about him. He doesn't come across as a professional criminal. I feel like he's doing this for the first time. But I wonder if they had cast someone who's a little more threatening, how that might have changed the film. It might have made us be have more sympathy for the couple who is being burglared and burglarized. And I wondered about that. And then there's Plemons. He's an actor I generally enjoy. I found his CEO a little predictable. He's sort of weak in the ways I might have expected, I guess. I wish he was a little more, a little less of a schmuck and a little more, I guess, manipulative or cunning, you know, in a way that where I could revel in some of that intensity. But yeah, it is, I thought, I love that it was brief, and I love that it was, you know, after seeing We Have a Ghost, this one is pretty much fat-free.
Yeah, it's very efficient is not a great word. I've used it already once in this episode, but it's pretty lean and practical storytelling that doesn't go into unnecessary diversions. And I liked how the your sympathies with the characters are constantly shifting over the course of the film. And I'd like to think that was on purpose because you should be on the side of the drifter, but you know, he's just hanging out. He's squatting and you know, doesn't really mean to intend anybody harm. But then all of a sudden the couple shows up and the stakes have changed, and then your alliance kind of shifts a little bit. I mean, you're kind of like, oh, this guy's just living his life. You know, he's not hurting anyone really, you know, maybe leaving a little mess or something, but you know, it's nothing that the wealthy owners of this country home are going to notice or be hurt by. And then everything changes. And Plemons is, you know, it would have been easy to play him as the kind of the one note evil CEO, but I find that there are certain moments where he's fairly sympathetic and he's way more animated than I'm used to seeing Jesse Plemons. I mean, I usually think of him as kind of he's playing kind of a slow witted, kind of character. I think of like on Fargo or in you know, Breaking Bad, which is where a lot of people probably first took note of him. And here I find he gets a chance to kind of expand his range a little bit and give us a character that's a lot different than what we're used to seeing him play. So there are lots of little pleasures like that along the way and over the course of the film. And I thought Lily Collins was pretty effective as the wife who has to, you know, kind of be almost the referee between the two of them as they argue about what people deserve and what people have earned. And it does have a lot to say about where we are in terms of how people are treated in this economy, as it were. So I felt there's a lot more to chew on in this film than We Have a Ghost. And at times I felt it maybe outreached its grasp a couple of times over the course of the film, but I felt for the most part it was pretty effective.
Yeah, I did too. I agree with you there. And I did like those conversations about the haves and have nots and what is what people are living with in this day to day and our lives and late capitalism. I did appreciate all of that. And yeah, like yourself, I really like Lily Collins. I mean, I think this is the kind of movie that it's very deliberate about where it's going, and it's building suspense and tension in a pretty effective way. But if it doesn't stick the landing, then you might feel pretty negative towards it. And I was really impressed with the film's conclusion. I found it very satisfying, and it's very much involves and relies upon Lily Collins' performance. And I thought she really sold it. I think that's what makes this movie work, is the fact that the ending is so good.
Yeah, I just love it when, you know, Jesse Plemons tries to get some sympathy by, you know, like, try being a rich white guy these days. You're just going around with a target on your back all the time, and everyone's waiting for you to fail. It freaking sucks.
Uh-huh.
And it's just like, yeah, no.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
That didn't work. And there's lots of fun little moments like that. And the stuff with when the gardener shows up and the kind of the chemistry gets changed a little bit, you know, and Jesse Plemons goes, this guy works for a living. You know, what do you do? And, just to kind of throw us off balance a little bit, I thought the film kept us guessing a little bit, and, it made it, very effective in terms of its balance between comedy and thriller.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, that's Windfall. Let's move on to another genre picture called Spiderhead. This came out about a year ago, I think. It's directed by Joseph Kaczynski, written by Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, based on the short story by George Saunders. What we have here is a slick science fiction drama mixed with tech anxiety, very much in the wake of Black Mirror, which we're seeing a lot lately. I mean, certainly Don't Worry, Darling had that kind of vibe. So what we've got here is a remote island-based modernist sort of laboratory that also serves as an unorthodox penitentiary. The inmates, such as they are volunteers, presumably to reduce their sentences from, the regular gen pop. While they're in this place, they live communally, and they have agreed to be the subjects of drug experiments, some of which are hallucinogenic, some of which are sort of reality warping, aphrodisiac, some are joy making, some are nightmarish despair generators, some improve your vocabulary and ability to use it, and some just make you hungry. Chris Hemsworth plays Steve Abnesti. He runs the place with all the energy of a tech billionaire. A very different flavor from the man who is Thor. He's a character who talks about being abandoned by his father quite a lot, but the American accent, I thought, was reasonably solid, and the egoism is real and it's raw, as are his rationalizations and manipulations. He's got an assistant, Mark, played by Luca Damasus, who's basically his dog's body. Then you've got the convicts, who seem to live with a lot of peace in this sort of brutalist communal environment. I'm all for conceptual sci-fi / prison thriller, but some of the concepts here I think are a little implausible. For instance, the idea that such a place, if it were ever to exist, there's no way the human test subjects and the people administering them would be in the quote-unquote summer camp where everyone is free to move around together and eat at the same kitchen. That just was like, really? Is that what we're having to accept here? Of course, the fact that everyone, including the people administering, have been hooked up to a permanent mood-filtering drug-administering device makes you wonder if maybe everyone's being managed, chemically speaking. And amongst the inmates, you've got Miles Teller as Jeff and June Smollett as Lizzie, who get friendly in the barracks, and their connection plays a role as Steve gets close to this final tests of specific mood and will-controlling drugs. Yeah, so that's basically the plot as it is. I know you've got Miles Teller is not your favorite guy, Stephen. Why don't you talk a little bit about how you felt about this film?
Yeah, well, I actually did enjoy the film. No, Miles Teller is not my favorite actor. I kind of lump him in with that group of actors like Jeremy Renner, and they all kind of look the same, and they all have this kind of what passes for rugged looks these days, and it's just not... just not really my cup of tea. And but here, he is kind of a jerk, so I guess that we can accept that. Our ostensible hero, obviously has some negative sides. He's in jail for a DUI, and so he has to seem like the kind of guy who would do that and kill his best friend in a drunk driving accident and have to deal with that kind of remorse while also undergoing these bizarre drug trials. And I like a good futuristic prison story as well. You know, I think of films like Fortress with Christopher Lambert. And there was one with Sylvester Stallone. Now I can't remember the title of it. I should look that one up. But there's, you know, that whole idea of a brutish regime inside this, you know, penitentiary. Here, this has like kind of like the opposite of that, and it still goes horribly, horribly wrong, which you know, makes you question our own ways of meeting out punishment in the legal system. So, and yeah, you're right. The idea that these prisoners are, you know, by cooperating with this program, they get a certain amount of freedom. But when there's a guy like Rogan in the mix, like this thuggish, tattooed brute, and you're like, well, does he have the same freedoms? He's clearly a psychopath. Why, you know, why would he have the same freedoms as Jeff and Lizzie? So there are certain conundrums in the way that that it's set up. And of course, we don't really get to know a lot of the other prisoners unless they're in some of the, there's a couple that are involved in some of the, like Rogan and Heather, who are sort of pawns in some of the drug trials scenes that we see. But obviously for matters of budget, because this seems like it was made while the director was waiting for special effects to be finished on Top Gun Maverick, because that was, you know, that's basically, you know, he's known for that in Oblivion. So he made this kind of, you know, one single set, minimal cast kind of thriller to kind of bide the time while a post-production was finished on that film. So, you know, it does have some of those limitations of its budget and small cast, but I thought it was an interesting idea that doesn't always hit the mark in terms of how it's explaining what's going on with these drug trials.
Yeah. There are some things in the concept that I like.
Yeah, exactly.
I do like how it comments on our stimulated culture, everything from our addiction to our phones to many prescribed substances. You know, some of this seems a little icky post-pandemic. Like, I'm sure this was all developed pre-pandemic, but some of the messaging might seem a little odd. You know, anti-vax, which is a little hard to take, I gotta say. But yeah. I enjoyed like all the late 70s, early 80s needle drops on the soundtrack, from Supertramp to Hall & Oates to the Doobie Brothers. That was all pretty cool.
Yeah, it seems like the sort of stuff that Chris Hemsworth's character would be listening to, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, for sure. And we sort of see a lot of it through his eyes, and we sort of flip between him, between Steve and Jeff, and their connection is, such as it is the sort of meat of it. But it is, a lot of the concepts end up being half-baked in the execution. There's a revelation about Steve that comes about halfway in. It's so anticlimactic because it's something I had already assumed about his character. And then there's a revelation about Jeff's past, the real reason he was jailed, which is revealed in a ham-fisted flashback that shows us a little more than a previous flashback. And I felt like the audience was being manipulated too. And I felt like if the screenwriters had given us a little more information about the other inmates, or just a little more depth to help us relate to these people, you know, there's a lot of cool stuff here, but it feels like a missed opportunity. And, you know, I guess the idea that I always thought from the jump, this is a horrific dystopic nightmare. So, you know, when plot developments roll out, the suspense is mostly absent. And it's a shame given the cool ideas that they're playing with.
Yeah. And I kind of wonder, like, you know, why would the prisoners need to have that much freedom? You know, you know, if they were, if they were under similar circumstances but with tighter controls, it would probably be the same kind of output.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but here they, you know, they have to give consent before they can administer any of the drugs and that sort of thing. And I feel like if it was that controlled and that dystopian, that, you know, that just wouldn't happen. They would just do the trials, and, you know, and they would just sign a waiver and for a reduced sentence, and that would be that. So I guess our main characters had to have some sort of illusion of free will, I suppose.
Yeah, and it makes the film seem like, to the audience, like, oh, I can see the appeal of this, like trying to soften it from the start. But I don't think they did that very well at all. Yeah, no, it's, I think, you know, I'm glad I saw it because it's stylish, and I think Kaczynski definitely can handle that. And I thought the performances were fine, but Spiderhead isn't something I'm going to be rushing out to revisit, though, you know, you might enjoy it if you're looking for something in that genre. speaking of genre, one last film to talk about in this segment, and that's Emily the Criminal, which I think was not developed under the Netflix umbrella, but was brought in and then distributed by Netflix. It's an independent film. It's written and directed by John Patton Ford, who I gather this is his, like, a first-timer filmmaker, and I really liked Emily the Criminal. It's not often that an indie picture comes along that really peels back some aching truths about society the way that Emily the Criminal does. And, you know, I think it, I compared it to last year's to Zola from the year before with an unexpected relevant edge. And it's also an amazing crime thriller. It just works on multiple levels. And that's what I like most about it. Speaking of, as we are, about late capitalism and the myth of American meritocracy, Emily is played by Aubrey Plaza. As a painter and illustrator from New Jersey living in LA, she has been working on her art lately. She's too busy working at a day job to pay off thousands of dollars of student debt with her catering gig that barely pays enough to cover the interest. She lives in a crappy apartment with roommates with whom she barely speaks. A friend from high school wants to get her, you know, help her get a job in a company she works at, but she knows, doesn't know when that'll happen. All this is complicated by Emily's record for past transgression, which includes a DUI and maybe more. A co-worker at the catering kitchen gives Emily a phone number and an opportunity. She'll earn $200 to do a little thing. It's illegal, using fraudulent credit cards to buy electronics, which are then sold off the back of a truck. But she doesn't. She pockets that cold, hard cash and starts a career in the black market. And then she clicks with Yusuf, played by Theo Rossi. He's the fellow who runs the operation with his cousin. And, you know, she never planned on these sort of criminal enterprises, sort of as a, and a, certainly they make it clear that as a white woman, she stands out amongst the visible minorities, people who are even more desperate than she is to eke out a living. But she's got a knack for it. She's got that entrepreneurial zeal. And this is, this is a film that really, I mean, Aubrey Plaza, who I've been an admirer of for some time, she just gets her teeth into this, and she is great in Emily the Criminal.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's very little of sort of the comedic schemer that we've seen in previous Aubrey Plaza roles here. She kind of, you know, bears it down to the bone to play Emily as a person who's you know, really scrabbling to keep her head afloat. And, you know, she really has our sympathy right from the get-go. And at the same time, you know, she's got some anger issues that clearly contribute to her misfortune. But you still root for her. You want her to, you know, to be able to claw her way out of this hole that she's in, that so many people find themselves in with student debt and things kind of compounding from there. And it's just that, you know, it really is, I guess, a modern noir in the sense that she's caught in this spiral, and the decisions that she makes, which seem like they're going to get her out of it, you know, tend to get her more ingrained into what she's doing. And it just has that classic pattern, as we follow her down, just trying to, you know, pay what she owes and get to the next step. And she's, you know, she doesn't know who to trust. And we, as an audience, you know, we characters present one face, and then we don't know who she can trust and who she can't trust. And it really keeps us on our toes through the whole running time.
Oh, for sure. I think for anyone who's watching, you know, looking for an interesting, compelling and intense suspense thriller, And if you've been, say, if you're making your way through the world with crushing debt, or if you've been undervalued and asked to work to the bone for a lot less than you deserve, or you feel that you're valued in your workplace, or if you've been expected to struggle through an unpaid internship while others do the same work for actual wages, I think there's something here for you to, I think there's something you could relate to in this picture. And I think Emily's desperate decision making will make all kinds of sense. But you know, it is. I really appreciated that sort of white hot rage seated in this noir's foundations, as you say. This is a noir thriller, but it's also entirely relevant.
Yeah, the logical extension of the gig economy is that eventually some of those gigs are going to be less than savory or less than on the up and up, and you know, Emily pays a price along the way, and it was fascinating watching her go through this cycle, not knowing where she's going to wind up. I really recommend this film.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Cameron Wilson, host of The Food Podcast. But you know what? It's not just about food. It's about people and their stories shared through the lens of food. The Food Podcast has been described as an audible fairy tale. How about that? You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. So come join us. We would love to share our stories with you.
Welcome back to Lends Me Your Ears. This week, we're looking at some interesting feature film offerings on the Netflix platform. And this is especially key because I will not be having Netflix probably a month or so from now. So it's great to get some of these titles under my belt and things that I've been curious about and things I've been actively trying to find time to watch. So that's the beauty of this show, is that we make time to watch the films that we talk about. So it's great to pick topics that encourage us to go in that direction. And the next two films certainly fulfill that that goal to be able to find the things that we think are worthwhile. In this case, we've got two very different films with some very high powered actors in the starring roles that were available on the Netflix platform. And the first one is The Wonder, which came out late last year, starring Florence Pugh and directed by Sebastian Lelio, who made the wonderful A Fantastic Woman, which I believe we talked about on this show.
Yeah, absolutely.
At one time in the past. It's a story set in Ireland. This film, I think, did show up theatrically in some markets, but not here, which is unfortunate because it's a gorgeous film. And it was interesting listening to interviews with Lelo about the film, about working in Ireland, which is sort of outside of his realm. It's in terms of the folklore and the culture. And the thing is that he really enjoyed diving into that and being able to see things in that culture and that behavior that maybe others wouldn't see, that things that only an outsider can bring to this kind of story. And I think he succeeded wonderfully.
Yeah, this is an interesting film. And I remember it came out a little later than Florence Pugh's Don't Worry, Darling. And I was more of a fan of Don't Worry, Darling. I think I was in the minority there. I think a lot of film critics were like, no, no, see The Wonder. If you're going to see one Florence Pugh movie this fall, see The Wonder. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I like The Wonder. I think I really like Lelio. Obviously, A Fantastic Woman, movies like Gloria and yes. Disobedience, which is a wonderful picture. Then you've got Alice Birch, who is the writer of Lady Macbeth. Beth on board here, which is another great film. And then Emma Donoghue it's based on a novel by Emma Donoghue, who wrote Room. So, you know, incredible, talented people here behind the scenes. And it's a story about science versus Catholicism, about empiricism versus belief. The mystery of the drama holds the interest, along with some stellar cinematography. Now, Pugh plays an English nurse. 1862, she's Mrs. Elizabeth Wright. She's been paid handsomely, quote unquote, to go to rural Ireland and spend 2 weeks to watch over a 9-year-old girl, played by Keela Lord Cassidy. She's told the girl hasn't eaten in 4 months and yet seems quite healthy. This is shortly after the Irish potato famine, which was largely blamed by the Irish on the Brits, so Mrs. Wright does not get a warm welcome from the locals. Now, Wright is rigorously fact-based in her efforts to understand what's happening with the girl, but also dealing with her own trauma and self-medicates when she's not hovering over her patient. She's trying to piece together the mystery of why she's still alive and a local gaggle of churchy or church-adjacent men, including Kieran Hines and Toby Jones. Great to see them. They want to sanctify the girl, while a local journalist, played by Tom Burke, sniffs around Mrs. Wright, hoping to uncover the truth through the nurse. But it is an odd one too, because it starts with, we open on a film studio just outside the wooden set of a ship's hull where we meet Pugh's character. The camera dollies in past rigging and lights to the set as a voiceover tells us, this is the beginning of a film called The Wonder. The people you are about to meet, the characters believe in their stories with complete devotion. We are nothing without stories, and so we invite you to believe in this one. And you know what? I'm not sure if that sort of artificiality or drawing attention to it really works. What is the point?
Yeah, it feels like a touch out of the French New Wave. That sounds like a Godardian trick.
Yes.
That doesn't, because once we're in the film, and it doesn't really matter. But I guess he wants us to think that, you know, it's a story.
Yeah. But and like work harder to suspend our disbelief, I guess. I mean, this isn't the French Lieutenant Woman's, which is the film I thought of, which justified its meta storytelling. It's just a little too obvious. And, you know, Lilio has a character staring right down into the camera at one point, and then we are reminded again of the artificiality at the film's conclusion. So it left me with questions, along with the score, which I thought was really strange, with this sort of horror-tinged atonal notes. I did love the performances. I thought Pew, as usual, she is just a force of nature. She's amazing in everything I'm seeing her in these days. And I would recommend it for her and, of course, for all these talented people. And some of the I admire the effort that they are doing to try to get their point across. I just didn't think it all worked.
Oh, well, I thought it worked great, but I love these kind of struggles between faith and science. And, you know, I was reminded of a film called I think I mentioned, we've never talked about it, you know, aside from sort of references, but there's a film called Brother of Sleep that I'm very fond of about a medieval Bavarian musician who believes he's divinely inspired, and the battle between him and the church elders, you know, that his music is nothing but pure noise. And this is in, you know, medieval, Bavaria, where he's playing this organ music that's driving people out of the church. And I like that kind of struggle between the divine and the earthly. And I just I felt once we got past that opening segment that where reminding us that this is a story, it's a fable, we can think about it in those terms, and ponder the characters' actions and beliefs based on that. I thought it worked pretty well, and certainly Florence Pugh is terrific as the nurse who's conflicted between her duty to the committee that is monitoring her progress in watching this girl and her own common sense about what's right from a medical standpoint. So I felt that maybe it touches on a lot of issues that we've been seeing happening in the public forums lately. And I love the setting and the gorgeous look of the film. I felt that part of it all worked for me.
Yeah, I guess I just struggled with the, like, I really like the concept. I half expected it to go all out supernatural horror rather than the low key look at the cost of religious fundamentalism. But I really, either way, I just wish it had maintained its ambiguity right to the conclusion. And I just was a little challenged by some of the storytelling manner, I guess. But again, Pew is great. It's a gorgeous looking film, and I would absolutely recommend people check it out. For the conversations, watch it with someone who you want to, you know, chip away at these issues with. And I think you would enjoy it. So the last film on our list today on Lends Me Your Ears here is called Earthquake Bird. I think it came out a little while back. It's directed by Wash Westmoreland. It's written by Westmoreland from the novel by Susanna Jones, and it is a character study wrapped up in a murder mystery. I would say it's an occasionally awkward but nevertheless compelling film, once again sustained by flawless performances. The Oscar-winning Swede, Alicia Vikander, who has made some pretty odd choices with her career since she won that Oscar for The Danish Girl back in, 2015. And this is one of them. She is the curiously named Lucy Fly. She's a translator and a cellist living in Japan in the late 1980s. When a woman of her acquaintance vanishes, a body parts are found and Lucy is brought in for questioning. And then we're in the recent past, where Lucy meets a photographer, a Teiji, played by Naoki Kobayashi, who asks her out on a date. He's kind of cold and affected, but then so is she. So slowly we begin to see beneath her facade. She's lonely, haunted by kind of a curse. She's not comfortable being close to people, but she has a friend, Bob, played by Jack Houston, who introduces her to an American newcomer, bartender and former nurse Lily, played by Riley Keough. And at first she finds Lily clumsy and uninteresting, but slowly they develop a connection, while at the same time she's becoming obsessed with the photographer. And the mystery is carried by this constantly shifting perspective of Vikander's Lucy. At one moment, we're sure this is building to a sort of a Hitchcockian crescendo of violence, and the film seeds her as an unreliable narrator. She's potentially delusional. Westmoreland, who I really like as a filmmaker, he did The Delightful Colette, which is a film I really enjoyed. He never lets anyone else usurp Vikander's domination of the screen, which I think serves the story well, even as Keough is an amazing performer. And I think we're starting to see that she's getting the kind of attention she deserves in Daisy Jones and the Six. Not a show on Amazon that I'd necessarily recommend, but I think she's really good in it. And I'm also always reminded she's Elvis Presley's granddaughter. I just feel like she's one solid role away from an A-list career, and I think she's probably getting it now, thanks to the Amazon show.
Yeah, this was this. I went into this knowing that it had had mixed reviews, and I think I probably did like it in parts more than the sum of it. But it did keep me going. I mean, Alicia Vikander is always so watchable in pretty much any role I've seen her in, and I thought that the Lucy Fly was a really interesting character, especially as we learn more about her past and about her kind of her guilt and remorse that she reveals more about as the film progresses, and we learn more about why that affects the way that she behaves when she's under the spotlight with the police and under interrogation, and why she has this attraction to the photographer Teiji, who I thought was well portrayed by Naoki Kobayashi. He's handsome, but there's also that sense of menace that is both like scary and attractive at the same time, and that's not an easy thing to pull off. And I thought he was great in that role, and sort of the attraction repulsion that happens between them, I thought was pretty fascinating. Any idea that this is like a mystery is fairly rote, because it pretty much just kind of goes along as we think it's going to. And I don't think there's any big reveals or anything like that along the way. Things kind of happen the way we pretty much are told they're going to happen. So in that aspect, I felt it didn't have a ton of tension or suspense, really. But I thought that the urban Japanese setting was really well portrayed in a way that maybe I haven't seen a lot in a lot of Western films. I noticed that we gather that he's a photographer, a pretty talented one, but he has these kind of, his day job is working in a noodle shop. And I noticed that it seemed to be the same set as the Midnight Diner series that is a Tokyo shot TV series that is also on Netflix. And it's a very charming series about the denizens of a midnight. It's almost like a cheer set in a Tokyo noodle shop kind of thing. I thought, and because I noticed some of the same props were on the wall and that kind of thing. Oh, that's very economical of you, Netflix, to use the same set from one of your other shows. But overall, I enjoyed it. It's not a complete home run on the mystery front, but I thought the cast was good enough and the setting and execution good enough that I didn't mind that the story itself was fairly pedestrian.
Yeah, I think I liked it. Sounds like maybe I liked it more than you.
I think so.
I think maybe my problem with it came at just in the ending. I felt like a lot of my goodwill towards the picture is squeezed in the conclusion that doesn't come close to sticking the landing.
Yeah.
Potentially, a surprising twist is unwound to deliver, I think, the most obvious result. And I think, you know, I always feel like the secret aim of screenwriting in movies is give audiences the ending they didn't know they wanted. And this one really fails. But again, as you say, Alicia Vikander is always watchable. You know, she's doing the series Irma Vep right now, which is based on the movie from the late 90s, and that is a really interesting project. I love the sense of style here, and Earthquake Bird, I think, is an unsettling pleasure for most of its running time. Though, you know, I think I would forgive some of those problems just by virtue of it being so different, right? And I mean, if this is the kind of thing, this sort of indie vibe that Netflix wanted to keep making, I think I would be right down with it. Like, I like these kinds of experiments. I like seeing something that maybe takes me by surprise, of course, right? I don't want to see the same thing over and over.
And that wraps up this week's edition of Lends Me Your Ears with a look at some noteworthy titles on the Netflix platform that you might want to go looking for. And we'll probably take a periodical look at some of the other platforms that are out there available. I'm looking forward to getting back on Apple and seeing some of the stuff I've only been reading about for the past year or so. You know, there's definitely going to be a lot of stuff to talk about when we revisit this particular format. Before we go, I do want to remind you that CKDU Sustainer Drive is coming up. It's taking place from March 24th to April 2nd. And we don't actually have a show that week because, of course, we are every other Tuesday on CKDU at 5 o'clock. But if you'd like to support the show, you can do so through the website is the easiest way. It's www.ckdu.ca/make-a-pledge. That's ckdu.ca/make-a-pledge. And you can support the station and what it does through the year through a few dollars a month or many dollars a month, depending on how much you listen to the station and how much you feel it gives back to the community, which I feel it does a great deal in terms of music and providing voices for those who aren't heard in other media. So keep that in mind when you visit the website and support the station that gives the community a voice that it doesn't normally otherwise have. You can find us online at our Twitter account at LensMeYourEars or our Facebook page. And you can find me on Twitter at NS_SCOOKE.
I'm also on Twitter. You can find me by my blog title, Flaw in the Iris.
Thanks again to everyone at the Village Soundcast Network who make this show so good by putting on the finishing touches. And of course, CKDU, who allows the use of their production studios to record every other week and air us on every other Tuesday at 5 p.m. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.
Lends Me Your Ears is hosted by Stephen Cook and Karsten Knox and is produced in Halifax, Nova Scotia at Village Sound for the Village Soundcast Network. All music courtesy of Gypsophilia. Send feedback to lendsmeyourearspodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.
This was a Village Soundcast Network original production.